Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This morning, with deep pride and soberness, I will pardon over 175,000 convictions.
In a sweeping move, the governor of Maryland has pardoned 175,000 marijuana convictions ahead of Juneteenth. We'll speak about the historic move with the chair of Maryland's Legislative Black Caucus, as well as a man arrested for marijuana possession at the age of 16. Then to the Holocaust and genocide scholar Roz Siegel. 8 months ago, the Israeli historian became one of the first scholars to accuse Israel of committing genocide in Gaza. Last week, the University of Minnesota rescinded its job offer for him to head the school's Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies. The decision has sparked outcry. We'll speak with Professor Roz Siegel.
We need to recognize what's going on around us, what's unfolding in front of our eyes, which is really a textbook case of genocide, with the rhetoric, with the actions, with everything involved.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At least 17 Palestinians were killed in the Gaza Strip overnight after Israeli warplanes launched refugee camps. This came after at least 9 Palestinians were reported killed in another Israeli attack while waiting for aid trucks to arrive in the southern city of Rafah. This is Hamad Dalul, the aunt of one of the men killed in the strike.
They are merchants. They had nothing to do with anything. They were struck with missiles. There's no safety, no safety. These are innocent people, honest people who had nothing to do with anything. They killed the merchants. They killed people. They killed children. They killed women. They have mistreated us.
In Jerusalem, at least one person was wounded and 9 others arrested Monday night as thousands of protesters rallied near the home of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Among those detained was a family member of an Israeli taken hostage by Hamas. It was one of dozens of protests taking place across Israel this week, demanding immediate elections and a Gaza ceasefire. This is 26-year-old Yotam Cohen, whose brother remains a hostage in Gaza.
The last 8 months have been an emotional roller coaster for me and the other hostage families. And I think that without a struggle and without the protest, this deal will also be put down. And we're here to tell the government and shout for them to close the deal and to bring them home.
The chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee has agreed to back the sale of $18 billion worth of F-15 fighter jets and other arms to Israel, following intense pressure from the Biden administration. New York Congressmember Gregory Meeks had previously held up the weapons sales after objecting to Israel's attacks on civilians. Maryland Democrat and Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chair Ben Cardin has also signed off on the sales. This comes as a French court has reversed a ruling that would have seen Israeli weapons traders barred from the world's largest arms expo. The Eurosatory exhibition opened in Paris Monday without the participation of Israeli delegates and intermediaries after peace activists successfully argued a government ban on Israeli companies operating booths at the event didn't go far enough. Earlier today, however, a commercial court reversed that decision. The International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, known as ICAN, is calling on the world's nuclear powers to stop ratcheting up tensions as a new report shows a surge in nuclear weapons spending. In a recent interview, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said the military alliance is weighing, quote, how many nuclear warheads should be operational and which should be stored, unquote. The U.S. currently has nuclear weapons deployed in Italy, Germany, Turkey, Belgium, and the Netherlands, while Russia has recently deployed warheads to Belarus. ICAN said, quote, the NATO countries hosting U.S. nuclear weapons should admit to their citizens that they have these inhumane weapons on their soil without their say. No country should be demonstrating their willingness to join in the killing of millions of people, they said. On Monday, Stoltenberg visited President Biden at the White House and spoke at the Wilson Center think tank, where he boasted of NATO's increased weapons spending.
NATO creates a market for defense sales. Over the last 2 years, more than two-thirds of European defense acquisitions were made with U.S. firms. That is more than $140 billion worth of contracts for U.S. defense companies. So NATO is good for U.S. security, good for U.S. industry, and good for U.S. jobs.
That's the NATO Secretary General. South Korea's military says its soldiers fired warning shots at about two dozen North Korean troops who crossed the heavily fortified demilitarized zone separating the two countries. It was the second reported border incursion this month and came as Russian President Vladimir Putin departed for a state visit to Pyongyang, where he's set to meet North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to discuss trade, weapon sales and military assistance. It's Putin's first visit to North Korea since 2000. In India, residents of New Delhi remain under a red alert, the highest level of warning, with daytime temperatures soaring past 110 degrees Fahrenheit. Meteorologists say northern India is in the midst of its longest ever heat wave, with highs in some areas pushing the limits of what humans can survive. In Saudi Arabia, at least 14 Muslim worshippers have died of heat stroke during the Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca. On Sunday, temperatures around the Great Mosque of Mecca reached 120 degrees Fahrenheit. In North America, an estimated 260 million people in the U.S. and Canada face temperatures of 90 degrees or higher this week as a persistent heat dome is forecast to settle over cities, including Chicago, New York, and Toronto. Meanwhile, in western states, crews are battling fresh wildfires that have exploded in Los Angeles, Northern California's Sonoma County, as well as New Mexico and elsewhere. This comes as dozens of labor and environmental groups petition the Federal Emergency Management Agency Monday to include wildfires and extreme heat in its definition of a major disaster, as both events are set to get even more frequent and more destructive due to the worsening climate crisis. The European Union has approved a landmark environmental law that'll require the bloc's 27 member states to restore nature on at least one-fifth of their land and sea by 2030. Over 80% of Europe's natural habitats are considered to be in poor health. At least 11 asylum seekers have died, and dozens are missing after two shipwrecks off the southern coast of Italy. Over 50 migrants were rescued Monday from a sinking wooden boat, while another boat, which had set off from Turkey, caught fire and overturned. Many of the refugees came from Syria, Egypt, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. The International Organization for Migration estimates more than 27,000 migrants have died in the Mediterranean Sea over the last decade as they attempt to reach Europe from northern Africa. The Biden administration's announcing a new policy that would protect tens of thousands of undocumented immigrants who are married to U.S. citizens from deportation and grant them a pathway to citizenship. The measure is likely to benefit some 500,000 people who've lived in the United States for at least 10 years and who would otherwise face mounting bureaucratic and legal challenges to obtain these protections if they entered the U.S. unauthorized. They'll also be allowed to obtain work permits. President Biden's announcing the policy at the White House later today, marking the 12th anniversary of Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, which provides deportation relief for undocumented immigrants who were brought to the U.S. as children. This comes just weeks after Biden issued a measure temporarily shutting down the U.S.-Mexico border and denying asylum to most migrants who do not cross into the U.S. via ports of entry. Here in New York, Governor Kathy Hochul has come under fire from health experts after saying she's exploring whether to reinstitute a partial ban on face coverings in public spaces. Hochul's comments came during an interview on CNN where she was asked by reporter Laura Coates if she would support a call by Jewish leaders to ban masks so pro-Palestinian protesters can be more easily.
I absolutely will go back and take a look at this and see whether it can be restored, because it is frightening to people. You're sitting on a subway train and someone puts on a mask like this and comes in. You don't know if they're going to be committing a crime, they're going to have a gun, or whether they're just going to be threatening and intimidating you because you are Jewish, which is exactly what happened the other day. Absolutely unacceptable in the state of New York.
New York City Councilmember Shahana Hanif called the governor's comments inexplicable and said a mask ban would, quote, serve to appease reactionary voices and go against logical health protections. Mask bans won't deter crime, but only hinder public health, Councilmember Hanif said. New York City Mayor Eric Adams has also backed a possible mask ban, citing protests as well as crimes committed by masked people. Meanwhile, New York City Comptroller Grad Lander and others say they will bring legal challenges to Governor Hochul's halting of New York City's congestion charge plan, which would charge drivers $15 to enter parts of Manhattan. The plan, which had been scheduled to go into effect later this month, would put billions back into New York City's ailing public transportation system and significantly reduce car pollution. A federal judge Monday blocked the Biden administration's expanded Title IX protections in Kentucky, Indiana, Ohio, Tennessee, Virginia, and West Virginia. The legislation was recently expanded to increase civil rights protections for transgender students, students who experience sex discrimination and harassment, and for pregnant people and survivors of sexual assault in schools. Days earlier, another federal judge temporarily blocked the new rules from taking effect in Idaho, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Montana. Title IX compliance is required to receive federal education assistance, but Republican states have been fighting against its expansion of protections for trans children. Thailand's Senate has overwhelmingly approved a marriage equality bill, making it the first country in Southeast Asia to recognize same-sex and non-binary couples. If Thailand's king grants final approval, the new law will allow any two people age 18 or older to wed and grants them equal rights to adopt children, inherit property, claim tax breaks, and more. This is 18-year-old Pleifa Kioka Shadlat, who helped draft the marriage equality bill.
Thank you for all your determination to see the same-sex marriage bill through. This is not just about amending a law. It is also going to change the lives of those in the LGBTQ community and their families. As an 18-year-old non-binary youth, this is an important step for society and for our future. We are very proud to make history today where love triumphed over prejudice.
And after half a century behind bars, former Black Panther Vironza Bowers has been released. He was sentenced to life in prison in 1973 for the murder of a U.S. park ranger based on testimony from government informants. He's consistently claimed his innocence. Many call him one of the longest-serving political prisoners in U.S. history. He was freed in May from the Federal Medical Center in North Carolina. In a video shared with Democracy Now!, 70-year-old Bowers said he became a healer in prison and hopes to continue his work on the outside.
And I learned one thing during incarceration, that a man or a woman has to sooner or later make a decision, make a choice as to how they intend to live life inside. Long ago, I made a decision. I made a choice to help my fellow men to heal and to find peace in the chaos. And that chaos will be raging all around, swirling. And anyway, I was able to do that by utilizing the soothing and healing sounds of my beloved shakuhachi. That's the bamboo flute that I blow, and meditation.
Vironza Bowers, former Black Panther, freed from prison after half a century behind bars. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, in a sweeping move, the governor of Maryland's pardoned 175,000 marijuana convictions ahead of Juneteenth. Back in a minute. ¶¶ an original composition by Veronza Bowers Jr., played on his five-hole bamboo flute known as a shakuhachi. The former Black Panther was released from prison in May after half a century. He credits his music and meditation with becoming a healer while he was incarcerated. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show in Maryland, where Governor Wes Moore made history Monday by issuing a sweeping executive order to, quote, right a lot of historical wrongs, unquote, by wiping out low-level marijuana convictions.
This morning, with deep pride and soberness, I will pardon over 175,000 convictions.
Governor Moore's move comes after Maryland legalized the use of recreational marijuana in 2022 when voters approved a constitutional amendment. The pardons will automatically forgive misdemeanor marijuana possession charges in Maryland's electronic court record system, as well as misdemeanor paraphernalia charges related to marijuana. The pardons do not impact anyone currently incarcerated. Governor Moore said he timed the pardons for this week of Juneteenth, the federal holiday on June 19th to mark the end of slavery in the United States.
No, that legalization does not turn back the clock on decades of harm that was caused by this war on drugs. Legalization does not erase the fact that nearly half of all drug arrests in Maryland during the early 2000s were for cannabis. It doesn't erase the fact that Black Marylanders were three times more likely to be arrested for cannabis than white Marylanders before legalization. It doesn't erase the fact that having a conviction on your record means a harder time with everything, from housing to employment to education.
That's Maryland Governor Wes Moore speaking Monday, the first Black governor in Maryland's 246-year history. He was joined by Anthony Brown, Maryland's first African-American attorney general.
Data uncontrovertibly shows that Black and Latino and white Americans use cannabis at the same rate, yet Black and Latino Americans are arrested, charged, and convicted at higher rates. Plainly put, the enforcement of cannabis laws has not been colorblind. It's been unequal treatment under the law. Maryland is a work in progress. The shackles of slavery, though physically removed, left an indelible mark on our state and our nation. The promise of Reconstruction was replaced by Jim Crow laws that stripped free Black people and treated us like second-class citizens. After the Civil War, instead of freedom, we experienced the emergence of the convict leasing system that exploited Black labor under the guise of punishment. Our current reality of disproportionate arrests and convictions are the residuals of slavery. The war on drugs was a war on communities of color. The data shows the deeply rooted bias in drug-related arrests and sentencing. Cannabis convictions for hundreds of thousands of people here in Maryland were scarlet letters, modern-day shackles. This morning, I can almost hear the clanging of those shackles falling to the floor with your pardon this morning, Governor. Thank you.
Meanwhile, the ACLU of Maryland notes anyone convicted of possession with intent to distribute can still face criminal penalties, including jail, despite the legalization of cannabis sales in the state. The penalty should be a civil fine, advocates have argued. For more, we're joined by three guests. Two of them were there Monday for this announcement. Jason Ortiz is the director of strategic initiatives at the Last Prisoner Project. His expertise on this issue stems in part from his arrest at age 16 for cannabis possession in Connecticut. We're also joined by Maryland Delegate Janelle Wilkins, chair of Maryland's Legislative Black Caucus. Also with us, Maritza Perez Medina, the Director of Federal Affairs at the Drug Policy Alliance. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Delegate Janelle Wilkins, we're going to turn to you first. We just played two clips of the two leading politicians in Maryland who are responsible for these 175,000 pardons. Both of them are African-American. Governor Moore is the first African-American governor of Maryland. And you are the chair of Maryland's Legislative Black Caucus. Can you talk about the significance of this when it came to this historic move? And actually, who does this cover?
Absolutely. As chair of the Legislative Black Caucus of Maryland, the largest Black caucus in the country, we know that leadership matters and representation matters. And especially as we embark upon Juneteenth tomorrow, this is a historic moment that we are so proud of. Our governor is the only person in the entire state that has the ability to pardon. And so for him to use the power of the pen to not only pardon a few, but to go big and also include various types of drug paraphernalia in his pardons really says a lot. Unfortunately, the war on drugs really impacted Black communities, and it still continues today in Maryland in terms of the results of these types of criminal convictions, whether it's housing, whether it's education, whether it's employment. So this really provides an impactful opportunity for equity and for those impacted to be able to live their full lives.
And, Delegate, could you talk a little bit more about how these convictions on people's records affect their ability to obtain housing, employment, and education?
Absolutely. One of the pieces of legislation, actually, that the Legislative Black Caucus of Maryland had as a priority this legislative session deals with banning the box on housing. When people apply, for example, to live in an apartment, they are oftentimes asked about their criminal convictions. And so even with something like cannabis, where we have legalized it in the state of Maryland, we have an equitable framework for how cannabis licenses are distributed, and we make sure that it's as inclusive as possible, people still bear the brunt of maybe having a cannabis conviction and having to say that they have that on their record when they are pursuing housing, and a landlord can decide that they don't want that person to live there. And so we did push legislation this year, which we will be reintroducing, and it was sponsored by Delegate Adrian Bowafo from Prince George's County, that we ban the box when it comes to housing so that individuals are able to freely apply for housing, be able to access housing, and for it to be something that is not a barrier for individuals with criminal convictions. Similarly, with obtaining certain licenses in the state of Maryland, there are sometimes background checks and criminal checks where something like a conviction for cannabis could prevent them from being able to obtain those licenses. So we see time and time again where those criminal convictions that were fueled by the war on drugs, despite the fact that Black people consume cannabis the same rate as other communities, we see that we are criminalized and convicted, charged, arrested more than any other community. It's unjust, it's unfair, and the governor taking this action really puts us on the path towards equity in our state.
I'd like to bring in Maritza Perez Medina, who's director of the Federal Affairs at the Drug Policy Alliance. Maritza, what's your response to the governor's actions, and did it go far enough as far as you're concerned?
I think it's great. This really is a sweeping pardon that's affecting hundreds of thousands of people. And what made this pardon distinct was that the fact that it included paraphernalia. I would like other governors to take similar action. I also want to say I also, you know, commend the governor for really couching this as a racial justice issue. We know that the war on drugs has targeted communities of color, so the relief should also target those communities, and the governor was very clear about that. So yes, this is really a historic announcement, and I hope to see other governors take similar action.
Can you talk more about what is happening around the country when it comes to this? And exactly what precedent Maryland has set here?
Yeah, so as I said, Maryland really set a precedent by including not just simple possession charges in this pardon announcement, but also paraphernalia charges. And this really opened the door to having more people have the records expunged, which is really, really exciting news. Like I said, it would be great to, for more governors to pick up a similar initiative. But really what we need is, you know, federal relief. I know that people are excited about the rescheduling review that the Biden administration is currently undertaking. At the Drug Policy Alliance, we think that this needs to go further. We need to actually deschedule marijuana and remove it from the Controlled Substances Act. It's important for folks around the country to understand that moving marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3 on the CSA will still maintain criminalization and federal prohibition. In fact, it's probably going to be incumbent on states to take more action, just given that the federal government, very little will change.
I want to bring I want to bring Jason Ortiz into this conversation. Jason, you are director of strategic initiatives at the Last Prisoner Project. You were there yesterday for this historic moment. But tell us your own personal story. Tell us what happened to you when you were 16 and how that shaped the rest of your life.
Yeah, thank you, Amy. It's an honor to be here today. And as you mentioned, I was arrested at the age of 16 in high school in Norwich, Connecticut. I was actually smoking with some friends on the way to school. And as soon as we got there, we were surrounded by security guards. They were kind of rough with us a little bit. It was one of the first times I've ever been like seriously in trouble. And when the police showed up, I realized that this was going to be something very different than I've ever experienced before. And I can tell you, whenever somebody puts chains on you, puts handcuffs on you, drug policy becomes a very real thing very quickly. And so for me, I got expelled from school, and so I lost 2 years of my high school career. I was alone and isolated for most of that time. I had to do after-school work while all my friends were actually out enjoying their lives. And so for a very long time, I was isolated. I had to go to court countless times, and my parents, who were not wealthy, there were two union-working parents, had to pay tens of thousands of legal fees just to make sure I wasn't permanently incarcerated. And it really derailed my entire life. But thanks to the work of advocates that were able to change the Higher Education Act's federal aid elimination penalty, I was able to go on to college and actually get my degree from the University of Connecticut. So I was negatively impacted by the war on drugs, but also positively impacted by the movement to change it and end it. And so yesterday was a historic day to be able to actually be a part of that. One of the charges that I did get as a youth was possession of paraphernalia, and it did actually increase the amount of potential time I could have served. And so to actually see the governor move on from simple possession shows the momentum of this movement, the momentum of this moment. And as Maritza said before, we do need to expand this to include other charges. I do believe that things like distribution and cultivation should also be included in these types of pardons. But as folks have said before, we do need federal action to really rectify the harms done by the war on drugs.
And I'd like to ask Delegate Janelle Wilkins, the work that still needs to be done. You've been very vocal about the issue of traffic stops by police who claim to smell cannabis when they stop a driver. You've got legislation. You've helped to co-sponsor legislation on that issue. Could you talk about that work that still has to be done?
Absolutely. The Black Caucus was very proud to work last year to pass legislation that ensures that just the smell and scent of cannabis does not allow an officer to search someone's car. And that was a really important bill because we saw that all across the state that Black people and people of color were being disproportionately pulled over due to the alleged scent of cannabis and being searched. So that was really important. But there's a lot of work still to be done on this issue. For example, it's critical that we create and develop more automatic expungements. We talk about these criminal records that people live with and bear the brunt of the challenges associated with having these convictions on their record. Being able to automatically expunge them and expand the types of crimes as well that can be expungible is absolutely critical as we are on this path.